Welcome to Start from the Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SWB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us by Talkcast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either dial on the phone, that is 605-562-0444. Just follow directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk Show website at www.talkshoe.com. Search for call ID 17702 or SF Starfleet Universe On Call. Or if you want to, this is cool broadcast onto the twitch.tv. And you can be in the chat room there. I keep an eye on the chat room to the whole broadcast. So you can listen to me there and listen to my... And actually watch me too. So in that case, you know, go there, which is twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. That's SFUONCALL. And you will find me there over on Twitch. Now, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is SFUOnCall@gmail.com. That's SFUONCALL@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, also, the Twitter account is SFUOnCall. Shocker! And have a personal account, Paul Franz. It's PaulFranz. There's no T in that. And if you want to, you can follow me there. Just a reminder that I'm a very big O's fan. I love technology and I love being a Catholic. So if any of those bother you, don't follow me. And of course, I have a tertiary account, which is the Franz Games website, Twitter account, which is for updates on the online clients, things happening on Starfleet Warlord, anything that's happening for those things that I am in charge of. Some quick news from ADB this week. We have, of course, the wonderful GURPS, revised GURPS Romulans is now available. So go grab it. It's available definitely as an ebook. I'm not sure if it's available as a regular book yet. Forgive me for... I saw the posting and I did not check to see if it was the regular book. But in hard copy, physical media. I love that. Something which I'm sure some people never thought that would ever happen again. Module H1, the Mega Hex module, which is... People, if you have the large maps, the Mega Hex module is awesome. The counter graphics are beautiful. And I would recommend that if you have a nice big map and you want to use these beautiful Mega Hex counters, buy it. It's now in stock. You know, I'm not sure how long, you know, how many copies they made, but go get it, you know. Also, the Federation Commander Klingon Border, the physical media, is back in stock once more, which is awesome. That means that the ship cards, the calendars, everything that's as part of that product. It's now available for those of you who like hard copies of physical media, like I do. Go get it. Now, also, one neat thing actually I saw, which actually it's from earlier in the month, and forgive me for missing this. And that is that they put out an Orion salvage tug with two freighters. Actually, not two freighters. It's basically two. It's supposed to be kind of two pods. You know, freighter pods. It really looks neat. So it's definitely one of those many I just wanted to mention. Obviously, you know, AD puts out new miniatures every single month, which is awesome to see because of that gives people quite a options when it comes to what ships they want. And if they play certain ships or have a quote unquote their fleet, whatever, that they got the ability to put their fleet on the map, paint them up, and just have a good old time doing that. Moving on and forward, actually, there's no Sapphire Star tournament, which is kind of weird. I'm not sure what's going on with that. Please, you know, keeping an ear out for that. There might be something soon. There is a Masters tournament going on, a very small Masters tournament. Had like 8 players. Things are going well there. And quick news on the online client. Actually, I did a little work on it this past week. There was a bug in something which some people rarely use. But I actually had 2 people trying to use it. Wow. Something that's rarely used and I have 2 people at the same time. Wow, that's a shocker. It really is. I'm not being, snarky about it, but that is that the if you have your own custom ships, and you try to add them to the client, add them to a room. If you try to have a custom counter, so it looks something like the ship that you just added. Well, that was not working. It just showed up the default icon. I have fixed that so that now that works fine. It will be part of the next release. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, the one and only Paul Francis, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, well, it's just me and Gary. Dave might be hanging around someplace. That would not surprise me, whether it is right here on the Twitch chat room or in TalkShoe. Unfortunately, TalkShoe currently does not tell me who's in the chat room, which is mightily annoying, but I can deal with it. But anyhow, Gary, how you doing?
Not so bad. There's actually been a fair few developments over the last couple of weeks that I thought might be worth going over one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I would love to.
Well, first of all, Steve Cole posted on the BBS that he's heard back from the printer.
Mm-hmm.
They should actually be shipping the counter sheets to ADB sometime next week, or arriving sometime next week, I should say, rather.
Right.
So things are going to be on the front foot in terms of the new Fed and Empire and FFB and other products that are, in the near window.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. I forgot to mention that in the news portion of the podcast. I did read that, which is awesome to hear that they finally printed up the counter sheets and they were going to be sending them out. I think they were done printing the counter sheets. I think that was what they said. I think what Steve Cole said. You mentioned some other things, which. I'm sorry, I read it and it was like, okay, you seem to indicate there was a lot more that people should read. I didn't see it. Other than the counters, obviously the counters are really important for multiple products that Steve Cole wants to, either release or update or make available,
Well, I guess part of it was to try to, light a fire under the various design teams and stuff, just to make sure that, things are in the works. So that's basically going to be just a reminder. That's going to be FedNE Tactical Operations, which is going to add a whole bunch of new ships for various empires for that game system. And then it's also going to be FNE Civil Wars, which is going to add the Wind Cluster as well as the Rebel counters for the Romulans and Kzintis and Lyrans.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And then that's also going to include modules R4J and R4T for Starfleet battles. And R4T,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of new Tholian ships.
Right.
R4J, Stellar Shadows, where the Romulans develop warp power by themselves.
Oh, cool. I gotta get that one. That was one thing that I put in the news portion, which is. I just saw they posted it on Facebook on April 1st, but I didn't see it last week. Last week I was on vacation. That's why I didn't post it. I forgot. I definitely enjoyed my vacation. Nice quiet time up in the Poconos. Me and my wife were up in a cabin, just us two. We didn't do much. We went out two, actually we went out to eat like twice. We ordered takeout another two times and just, you know, enjoy just quiet, you know, living more, it's a pretty simple existence. You know, for like a week, which was nice. But one of the things that they announced actually was that Mega Hex. You ever seen the Mega Hex product, Gary?
Yeah, there's one that they had which has it basically includes some of the Fed Commander counters as well as counters for various SFB products too.
Okay,
like,
yeah,
in like. Large size and regular size.
Yeah, yeah. The nice large hex counters. These are beautiful counters. The graphics on them are much better than the standard, you know, little shadow counters that they have. You know, which you can understand because those small counters are, you know, what kind of resolution can you get on those little small counters, really? But the Mega Hex ones are they're gorgeous. And you know, if you ever, if I mentioned people on the news portion, I said if you have a large format map, get these counters. So because these are gorgeous, you got if you use counters every once in a while, and you know it's nice to have like, if you have the you know miniatures that you use, you play with large format, because I'm assuming that most people with large format maps actually use them for miniatures and not counters, but this is a good substitute in the case you don't want to bring out, you know, bring out your miniatures and just have the counters.
Well, just a reminder that Federation Commander, like the main modules, each come with map boards that have the large size hexes on one side and the regular size on the other.
Right.
So FC is designed from the outset to support both counter scales. So.
Right.
It's more like an SFB thing that it's unusual to have larger counters, but from an FC perspective, it's fairly normal.
Yep. Actually, that reminds me of that. There was a person on Facebook. You know, one of the people was talking to another person, and they mentioned about that. There was a SFB equivalent of BattleTech Alpha Strike, and the one person replied that there actually is, which is ACTA SF, which I had to reply after I grabbed a copy of ACTA SF, this was annoying to me, which was you have to buy both the version revision one. You know, it's 1.2 and 2.0 to have the complete set, to have all the rules. To me, that was kind of annoying. I thought the idea was book two would actually replace the previous one, but obviously not. I was incorrect.
No, what you're thinking of is book 1.1 was the original. 1.2 is the same ships, but with a revised game system.
Right.
Book two is an expansion that includes the Saltorians and the Neo-Tholians and full Orion fleets and so forth. So, and additional ships for the other empires and stuff. So think of it as more as an expansion rather than a replacement.
Right. Oh, agreed. But I didn't know that it was an expansion. But anyhow, I read the rules for that. Some I actually grabbed a copy of the BattleTech Alpha Strike to do a quick, you know, comparison, and then I replied and said, "Yeah, the Call of Arms Starfleet is basically equivalent to BattleTech Alpha Strike, you know, in that, you know, uses miniatures in both aspect. They're hexless, and you know, and they both have a simplified battle system, comparatively speaking.
The only thing is that Alpha Strike actually it reduces things down a lot more because so what Alpha Strike actually is that years ago BattleTech had a spin-off, a sister game called Battle Force, which basically gave you each mech or unit or whatever would just have one row of dots for the armor and another row of dots for the endoskeleton or the structure, you know, like the my armors and stuff. And in the original Battle Force, it was basically meant to be like you'd use like a lance at a time or something. It was like for bigger battles and stuff. So right. Office Strike was basically born from a spin-off called Quick Strike, which kind of like pared that back and turned it so that you basically used individual mechs for individual like stats. Or I'm not explaining it very well, but the scale of reduction is a lot more. Although actually what's interesting is that Alpha Strike does do a few things that Total Warfare or Classic Battletech doesn't do. Like, for example, there's bigger, there's more of a focus on fast-moving mechs because enemy mechs have like a hit modifier, depending on how fast you're going.
Right.
And I don't think Classic Battletech has that. So it's like smaller mechs that in Classic Battletech are less effective suddenly become more so in Alpha Strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For those people looking at the video, I'm looking at the introductory Alpha Strike, which was interesting. Yeah, and I agree. It boils things down a little more when it comes to weapons and so forth. You have a general. Okay, this is how much damage it can put out at the different ranges.
I should actually point that just the way the Federation Commander has the Commander Circle, where there's a number of like low toner versions of ship cards. The folks from Catalyst Game Labs have actually there's a website called the Master Unit List, mm-hmm. where you've actually got a whole load of different mechs and tanks and stuff. That actually, if you look up the page, it'll actually show you the equivalent Alpha Strike card for many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, say for example, if you look up, say the Clan Timberwolf, they have different MUL entries for the different Omni-Mech configurations, and each of those, if I recall correctly, should have its accompanying Alpha Strike card. So that basically gives you a more of a chance to kind of get stuck in.
Mm-hmm. What's the website again?
If you Google BattleTech Master Unit List, I think it's something like masterunitlist.info, but don't quote me on that because what you can also do is that if you go to Catalyst's homepage for BattleTech, there's actually a list of links. Like one of them, so they're the Iron Wind Metals who do a lot of the miniature stuff.
And masterunitlist.info.
I forget what. Yeah, that should be it. I think.
Eras. Go with Age of War. Whoops. No faction data available for Age of War. Okay, Star League? Let's go Capulan.
Yeah, the Age of War stuff is kind of like equivalent to what we would call the early years in SFP. Because it's basically primitive mechs that have less powerful weapons and armor.
I'm kind of shocked. I'm honestly shocked that this is actually on a website freely available for people. Well, it looks like I'm assuming it's from Catalyst Games itself. Okay.
Yeah, because, you still go out and buy the various books that include the record sheets that are used to create the Alpha Strike cards.
Right.
So I guess that's the real bread and butter. I guess it helps people who do want to get into Alpha Strike that material is there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, geez, that brings back memories. Technical readout books. It's been a long time. The last time I played, I haven't played BattleTech for. It's probably been 30 years. I think it's back in my college days. Last time I played BattleTech. Which was like 30 years ago. Probably more than that.
Well, they are now, as of the 1st of January this year, into the beginnings of a brand new era, the Ill Clan, starting in the year 3151.
Mm-hmm.
So, because before Catalyst, there was never really any kind of formal breaking up of the eras.
Right.
But Catalyst have actually broken up into, well, it was originally it was six, but now it'll plan at seven.
Yeah,
so
to a certain
like,
degree,
for example, Dark Age covers that.
Right. To agree, there was kind of, when I first was introduced to BattleTech, there was definitely at least two different eras. There was the Starleak era, and then there was the basically kind of the fall, whatever you want to call it, where everybody kind of split up and the Star League was no more. That
was succession wars.
Right. And you know, there was no material for the previous one, but it was known that that was there, basically. And then last thing
actually there is now, because there's a number of two, actually they're really good actually, because there's two historical books that look at the Star League Civil War, mm-hmm. and there's another one that looks at the reunification war that was fought at the very onset of the Star League. And there's also like era settings like for mid Star League play, and there's even one where it's called Historical Operation Klondike, mm-hmm. and it basically looks at the formation of the clans after their exodus into the deep periphery. Right. So even before like the classic clan mechs like the Timberwolf and stuff were created, this was basically showing how the exiles from the Star League Defense Force evolved, or whatever way you want to put it, into the clan, like the origins of the clans as we know them.
Mm-hmm. That was the last thing I got some clan mechs, the technical readout book for the clan mechs, and also I'd read like one of the fiction books. I only read one fiction book about the clans, which was interesting. And that was the last time I was involved with BattleTech. To the degree that I haven't got any BattleTech for years. You know, that was during that era for me. the BattleTech era for me. That is, there was the original BattleTech, I think DOS-based game, where you could play BattleTech as a BattleTech mech, which was interesting. But anyhow, to bring us back to the Starfleet universe, I agree that the Alpha Strike is boils it down more than Call to Arms, though Call to Arms definitely, it's in my mind, it still gives you the flavor of Starfleet battles, in that it still has the idea of shields and weapons. Though, you know, obviously the amount of weapons is completely boiled down, though you still have arcs and things like that. So, you know, it has not gone down to the abstraction point of BattleTech Alpha Strike. So I have to agree with that.
Or Fed and Empire, for that matter.
Yeah, Fed and Empire has gone even further. Yeah. The thing is that Alpha Strike is right in the middle between those two, between Call to Arms and Fed Empire. It's in between there, because you're still at Fed Empire level. You're no longer dealing with the tactical board. You're plainly just saying, okay, here's your fleets. Here's the makeup of your fleets. This is how a battle interacts with each other in an abstract fashion, with the offensive and defensive potentials and all that kind of thing. You know, how much damage it can take and so forth.
Actually, it just occurred to me, Starfleet Battle Force. Because if you look at each card for a ship in that game, it still has like a rough look at like what the weapons are and stuff, whatever, but it's very boiled down compared to even FedCom.
Oh.
Or Arc XSF, for that matter.
I agree. But still, I guess the to me the defining line is that we don't have anything between those two that actually define on a tactical board. You know, I mean that's as abstract as Alpha Strike, but still tactics based, still has the idea of tactics involved.
Just one final note I'll add is that there's a relatively recent core book called Interstellar Operations for Battletech, and it actually includes their equivalent of Fed and Empire. It's called Inner Spirit War. Mm-hmm. And that one basically brings you to the point where you basically have a map of the inner sphere and you're, you know, battling it out or whatever. But it doesn't have nearly as much support as Fed and Empire has. Like it's almost like a, like there isn't quite the same, like, you know, like how, like with ADB, there's a very strong effort to balance the fandoms, like the FNE team, the SFB team, the FFC team, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But with Catalyst, it seems like, yes, they do products like role-playing games and that kind of thing, whatever, but most of the oxygen is soaked up by a classic Battletech.
Understood, yeah. And though, geez. I don't know the Battletech system, because obviously one of the things that FNE does is that the whole idea is you're playing out the general war. That's why there's like scheduled production, and you can tweak the production a little bit, but you can't just say, okay, here is the territory which you start out with, go, you know, and just give you production and so forth. Basically, almost like a 4X product, where you can build whatever you want, and there's no set schedule and so forth. You're just given options. So, Gary, you still there?
Are you having trouble hearing me? Because the signal's very choppy from you on my end.
Much better now. You were breaking up just a little bit ago. How do I sound?
You sound kind of muffly, but I don't know. I guess it'll, as long as the recording isn't affected.
Yeah, if, as long as all this on my side, the recording should be okay, though. Obviously, if it's bad for Chris, hopefully you're still there. And actually, Dave, you might know, and that is whether I'm sounding choppy to you guys. Okay, Dave says it sounds clear for him. And Chris, I'm assuming it sounds clear for you. If it doesn't sound clear, please tell me. But, you know, so that means it's probably on your end. Do you have someone playing, doing a lot of streaming or something like that?
Well, I don't know. Okay. Do you think I should like try to call back in or something? Or
No.
Do you think it won't make a difference?
How am I sounding right now? Am I still choppy?
Okay. So, I was thinking, like, also the second thing is, there's been a number of discussion threads that have kicked off on the BBS lately, to do with either new products or with, like, I guess they're all new products in one way or another, or proposed alternate timelines. So, for example, Mike West was proposing a Stellar Shadows timeline where the feds develop without any drones.
Yeah, I saw that thread. And I also saw one of Patrick's replies to that.
There's also been discussion about a potential Home Galaxy module.
Mm-hmm. You mean Tholian Home Galaxy?
Workout.
You mean a Tholian Home Galaxy module? That thing?
And yeah, so it already, like, there's a main thread for that in the SFB new product development section. And there's a couple of sub-threads in that area, like one's for the Home Galaxy Pirates and one's for the Nebuline. But I guess much of the discussion is trying to find a way to account for pre-conquest Tholian history that works for ADB. So there's been a bit of back and forth about that in recent days.
Yeah, it looks like it started up. I'm right now I'm going back to module RM81, and it looks like into this. Oh, actually, it started like the past week or two. Okay, cool. I'm not actually no. I'm just reading this one reply by Steve Call, which was, and of course, there is a potential that other extragalactic invaders to show up, perhaps at some point in the post-revolt era. It could be, that intergalactic trunk line that is already being built in the direction of one of the M81 satellite galaxies. And Steve Call says, no, dead horse, don't bring it up again. So.
Yeah, but all I was going to say is there's also now it didn't it, I was hoping that it would actually be in its own separate thread, but it's kind of like in a thread in a discussion that's like one level up, if that makes sense. And that was basically proposing a potential like module C6R that could be like a reinforcements module for the Lost Empires. So
Right.
that would basically, because rather than trying to shoehorn those empires into other products, a reinforcements pack might be a better way to keep them all together. And so, for example, if anyone wanted to have, say, X ships for the Lost Empire Paravians and Carnivans, or local defense ships, or maybe dedicated starbase SSDs, or new unit types, or whatever, they could all go there. And if any of those units end up being, borrowable for other settings where either of those two species might show up, then all the better.
Cool. I would be really, really excited about an M81 module. That'd be so great. That'd be so cool. I'll definitely keep an eye on that.
And
I saw that, but
oh,
I
and
didn't really I
also
didn't really see it, one of those things. But anyway, sorry.
And one other thing is over on the FedCom forum in the miniature section, there's some guy with relatively not that great painting skills who has nonetheless tried to apply brush to plastic to see if he could do anything decent. So if you have a look, you might see three new Shapeways of Rivals as they were like when they first arrived, and then through a couple of different phases of painting efforts.
Okay, I'm looking for
And of course, that person, yeah.
where what topic on the FedCon forum?
If you go to
Is it under
the
miniatures?
miniatures, like the,
Okay.
yeah. Not the well yeah not the Starline. Well, there's like a couple of like the first of the, I don't know how to explain this, like the way the FC forums like in three groups,
Yeah, Federation Commander,
so
Starfleet
like
Alec Gallery, and other Starfleet products.
yeah, so in other, the first heading for miniatures, if you go in there and then there should be a thread that says my ADB Shapeways miniatures. So if you click
Okay, I
on
see it.
page three, the third page for that,
Oh, okay, let me go back.
or page two even, because page two will actually start things off, like if you scroll down a bit.
There. Ah, there they are. Okay. Interesting. I like the IC painting job. That one looks really good. And next. Okay, that one looks, that's better. Paravian looks pretty good. Did not like the M81 OGR. I'm not sure if the painting is kind of rustic on purpose or just he wasn't able to get the paint, a smooth layer of paint.
Yeah, it's more of a work in progress than the other two.
Yeah.
But now just to clarify, are you at the very last pages, like showing the second revision or just the first revision?
No, I'm looking at the second revision, and even with the second revision for the OGR, yeah, you know, it's still, I don't like the swirlies when it comes to the green paint. You know, some of the other more, you know, the rustic stuff for like the Paravian and the ISC, those work beautifully, you know. Those look great, but you know the M81 OGR.
The thing about the problem with the OGR is that it doesn't have a lot of. It's got a lot of empty space.
Right.
Whereas the print is almost like it does the paint. It does a lot of the work for you because it's got all those feathers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just big enough to paint. Because, like, for example. Some of the Fed ships, because you can get the Fed ships in the classic mode where they have no hull panels, and the regular, like the Mongoose style one, where it actually does show you the panels. But the panels themselves are relatively small, so it's more difficult, well, for me anyway, it's more difficult to paint them properly mm-hmm. Without spilling into the subsection. But with the Paravian, the heavy cruiser anyway.
Right.
Are just big enough to make it easier.
I agree that the INC and the Paravian, both of those have those little things that, you know, define, you know, the ridges and things that give it more texture versus the OGR. The OGR is very flat. There's not much when it comes to little details, at least shown with the painted variety. I did not look at the unpainted one to do a comparison, and I might not be able to see much detail because of the kind of miniature he got. But yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what you can do to make it still have that rustic feel without it looking. Yeah. You know.
If you go to the second page and scroll mostly down, you should see the unpainted versions.
Right.
The problem, though, is that because they're smooth fine detail plastic, they're very translucent. So it's harder to pick out some of the features. Although, of course, you know, for cloaked ships, they're great because, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you could almost, yeah.
Okay, I see it. Okay, now I'm assuming, yeah, from looks of the OGR, looks like there's not much detail here. I'm assuming that I'm seeing like four boxes on the wing. I'm assuming those boxes actually are on the underneath of the wing.
They're the tractor beams.
Okay.
Because if you look at the painted version, you'll see these like the red rails mm-hmm. On either side mm-hmm. of the kind of inner so if you look at the underside of the wing, it's got the four tractor beam squares in the middle of the wing, and then on where the side warp engine is, you see one red rail.
Right.
And then where the wing meets the hull, there's two red rails. Mm-hmm. So my assumption is that those are basically kind of to make it easier to secure the freighter when you've connected to it, when you've talked to it.
Right, which was I agree that that's one of those kind of ideas which is kind of neat. You know. Oh, did you? I mentioned this in the news portion. Did you see the new Orion Slaver that they released this month?
You mean the tug that has?
Yep.
That's basically stealing the old Galaxy Pirate's thunder by like pulling off freighters themselves. How dare they?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was kind of a neat one. I mentioned it in the news portion of the podcast, just because of I thought that was kind of a neat idea to do. You know, I thought it was kind of a cool one which was kind of unique. You know, that's why I pointed it out.
Well, the saving grace is that. Because with the case of the OGR and the OGD, which doesn't have a ministry yet, but it will at some point, is that like those three engines that are on there, mm-hmm. the one that's on the wing, it only provides warp power when there's not a freighter docked. But when there is a freighter docked, then you can get warp power from it. So like if it's a small freighter, you can still move pretty fast. And if it's a large freighter, you can still move like about, I guess, speed 24 or so. So you can still motor at a decent clip, whereas with the Orion, you'd have to double your engines to do that, and that's going to risk causing engine damage, you know, before you do
that. Right, yeah, you don't double engines when you're hauling that stuff, because most of the time you're hauling that stuff long range. This is, it's not something you do, you know, you're taking the freighters to go have them chopped up and all the cargo to be, you know, extracted, you know, and so, you know, and sold and profited from, you know. What would help with this guy? This is you. Help with the pictures? Is seeing the underside. Yeah, Gary, I just noticed that you're the one who posted these pictures.
Yes. I was wondering when you'd register that.
It probably clicked. It's like, what the heck? Yeah, actually, what we need is actually see the underside, because I think the underside actually shows more detail.
Mm. But what I was going to say as well is that I think one of the interesting side things about the OGR Mini is that, especially once you paint it up, for nothing else, now, it does give a better sense about what bits could be removed in order to make the standard Nebuline warship. Because remember in the Pirates of MA, well, part of the discussion over in the BBS, like for the MA-1 Galaxy, is that the OGR, as we see it, for one thing, it's an export model. So it's kind of like a Wynn Orion compared to a true Orion pirate.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the species or empire that built them originally, the Nebuline, they adapted them from wingless, or I guess stub wing, you could call it. So if you look at the right side of the OGR, if you kind of mirror that on both sides, that brings you closer to what the original warship would have looked like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at there is a picture of the underside. I found it on page 3. Do you plan on doing anything about those bumps? About painting the bumps maybe a different color or something?
I don't know. I mean, like, as I say, I'm no expert in stuff, because I think the problem is that because I was using a white primer for all three, and mm-hmm. I find that the white primer works great with yellows and reds, and to a lesser extent with blues, but it really doesn't like greens.
Yeah, I kind of noticed that. Yeah.
I'm actually fairly okay with how the Paravians are turning out so far, though.
The Paravians are looking beautiful. I agree there.
In fact, I actually think that if you look at the bottom of the Paravian, I kind of like the idea that you see the way like that. There's like an A shape underneath the prow, and there's like two sets of feathers that are painted yellow at the back instead of on the bottom instead of gray.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like the idea that those are the actual landing pads. That instead of the Paravians, doing what other empires doing, and like kind of like putting a more kind of like obvious looking, this is landing pad, this is landing pad. I like the idea that they're more subtle about it, and that they integrate it into the feather design.
Understood. Okay, cool.
Well, that's just my own idea, but that hasn't been confirmed one way or the other.
Right, because, the Paravians actually could land on planets.
That's right.
Which is, when it comes to ships landing on planets, it was always an interesting idea. By the way, Harley Quinn, yes, it is Paul Franz. And I finally knew who Harley Quinn is. but anyway, yeah, to the point. Yeah, that's, I always thought that was kind of interesting. I know there aren't that many that actually land on planets. Obviously, a lot of the Romulan Romulan ships land on planets. You know, that's one of the things that they would do, which, from a purely tactical, makes a lot of sense to me. If you want to get a lot of troops on the ground and safely on the ground, well, transporters would actually make a lot more sense in that regard, wouldn't it?
Well, bear in mind that before the Treaty of Smarva, the Romulans had no transporters.
Oh, yeah. Oh, understood.
Some of the earlier scenarios actually have it that the Romulans used their various like masking or veiling technologies. They'd sneak up to a Gorn planet. They'd land their ships, point their torpedoes skywards, and then dare the Gorns to basically wade through a wall of plasma to retake the planet.
That's interesting. That would work because early years, the Romans, before they actually had tactical warp, that makes absolute sense. But what were you going to say, Gary?
Oh, speaking of the Romulans, because one other Stellar Shadows idea that I was inspired to look back on with this miniature was I was thinking that there could be like in one of the Lost Empire timelines, instead of having a Treaty of Smarva, you could have like a Treaty of Circle Trigon where it's the Paravians who sell warp technology to the Romulans rather than the Klingons. And if you made the treaty happen earlier, like say in Y-130, you could even have the Romulans either import a handful of Paravian ships and convert them to their technology,
mm-hmm.
or you could even have the Romulans consider building their own Paravian hulls under license. So the handy benefit with that would be is that if anyone out there who collects Romulan miniatures for Shapeways, that would give them an excuse to add Paravian miniatures to their mix as well.
That is true. That is true. And that, wow. The interesting kind of tying together the two is that obviously the Paravians were bird creatures. And of course, yeah, as Chris was pointing out, that Romulans like bird ships, war hawks, battle hawks, that whole thing, and kind of a little synchronicity there.
And especially because if you think about it, if the Romulans get middle year ships early, their own ships, like the War Eagle, they're limited in speed. Like they can't go faster than speed 24. So if they had an extended period where imported or licensed-built Paravian ships would be their only ships capable of fighting at speed 31, then that would kind of help distinguish things tactically, but also it might influence Romulan development because Paravian ships also land on planets.
Right,
and they have like all the weapons are up the front, although the Shapeways miniature seems to put the quantum wave torpedoes in the wings themselves. But, in principle, any future Romulan development that was inspired by the Paravians could go in a very different direction to the Sparrowhawks that were influenced by the Klingons.
Right, right. Obviously, if they were more influenced by the Paravians, that I would think that maybe they'll have some of the lighter torpedoes on the wings, but have like a main, or maybe an R, stick with like the R, having an R torpedo with most ships, that'd be part of the main fuselage. And Harley Quinn, just really quick, I'm not sure if you talk about conventions. Are there other plays of playing SFB? Yeah, there actually is a cadet version of SFB available using Vassal. That's one way of doing it. And obviously, there's other ways of playing Starfleet battles, which involved basically using like Zoom or Skype or something along those lines to play that way. Oh, tournaments. Currently, the only place to play tournaments is SFB Online. Okay, back to our discussion. Sorry, I had to reply to somebody that's in the chat room on the Twitch channel. So
I feel like. But yeah, if you're curious about that whole Rodman and Paravian idea,
mm-hmm.
The same on the BBS where that no drone fed discussion is, you would see a separate thread for the Rodman and Paravian concept.
Okay. Ba-ba-ba-ba. Okay, is it the call of the PR series and alternate war hold all derivatives? Is that what it is? No, that's not it.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah, because okay. I originally started it before Module C6 came out, so I didn't have the full info. But if you scroll further down the page,
yeah,
I kind of revisited it more recently and with more, what I hope is more informed ideas.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. 8 years ago.
With the Shapeways miniature imprint available, because I have to confess, I think the Shapeways version of the Paravians look a lot better than the ones on the counters, like the, you know, the line art version of the Paravians. Mm-hmm. But then I feel the same way about the Mongoose Sparrowhawk compared to the classic Sparrowhawk. And, you know, mileages vary, so I don't want to, you know, naysay anyone who prefers the classic look. So it's a purely personal perspective.
Understood. Okay. You're lucky that Steve Cole didn't delete it. Because I see a comment here. It's like, oh, from Mike West, Steve Cole, this likely can be deleted. And that was back in 2019.
Yeah, I don't go into his discussion threads and ask them to be deleted. So
kind of no, like, well, I understand what they're trying to do. Because the discussion board has a limited amount of threads and topics that you actually can have going at the same time. And then after some point, basically it starts breaking down. And so they have to clean up every so often. And I had to clean up some of my SFB Online topics. And which is easy enough to do. I actually have a little script that I have, which actually can download a whole topic thread and create a text file based on the thread, which is kind of cool. I still have, I've saved off the infamous pure impulse activity versus call for fire thread, which is now deleted. But I got an archive of that one. Whew. Interesting.
Well, the only thing is that when it comes to the Romulans using Paravian ships, well, there's a couple of things. One is they don't have too many plasma points, like to take off the quantum wave torpedoes into the plasma zone, so that's okay. That's part of the character.
Right.
Now, the Romulans might reduce the number of boarding parties, because like a Paravian heavy cruiser, I think it's got like 20 boarding parties, but like the Klingon versions of Kestrels tend to have more boarding parties too, so maybe the Romulans might dial that back a bit as well. But I guess the main question would be in terms of the cloak costs, because Paravian ship would have the same high cloak cost that a Kestrel would have. So how would that be, how much of an issue would that be for the Romulans going forward? I mean, like, would they be okay with it, given what else the ship can do? Or would it encourage them to go a third way, the way that the standard Romulans did with the Sparrowhawk?
Right. It definitely would be an interesting idea to pursue. I definitely feel like it's probably, I almost want to say it's a dead end, but well, more to the point, will there be any possible, work done on it as a possible shadow, future or, shadow history, one of the Stellar Shadows proposals. Will it be worked on? Don't know.
Oh, actually, while you're here, if we could double back to the M81 stuff for a minute.
Like, I would go anywhere.
Okay. I've tried to be part of the discussion, but at the same time, I didn't want to be the guy who kind of dethroned Lauren Knight as like the point guy on M81. Because, he's the one who has put a lot of work into like the material that's in things like Away Team Log, that's aimed at like Prime Directive phone-ins and stuff. So,
right.
Now bear in mind, ADB always have the final say. So,
of course,
they're still that. But I did have a couple of thoughts in terms of what, because as I say, we've seen the OGR miniature and stuff. I've been trying to think about what the technology could be like that the Nebulae themselves use that could make things interesting. So I don't know if you had a minute. I should warn people that it's entirely possible that this might get overwritten by something else that ADB or Lauren Knight or someone else might have in the works. So it's just a thought experiment. But nonetheless, I wonder if you wanted to spare a minute or two to have a think about it.
Understood. Yeah, I was just reading Steve Cole's last post, which was about the history of the Tholians. And Steve Cole said, I kind of like the variant of Douglas Sedana's theory of the Tholians' origins, not as wandering gypsies, but as people who are like a hydrant settled on super hot planets nobody else wanted, e.g. Mercury. Imagine a human society that was spread to Mars and Titan and floating cities in the upper atmosphere of Venus. One day, the Tholians show up and take over Mercury. They don't threaten us because they're no real interest in trade. We can see them coming and going, but they don't talk to us. There goes on for a few centuries. Then one day, a whole bunch of extra Tholians show up, and guess what? You're now subject to the Tholian will. Which, to me, that's interesting. Oh, what's crap? What's that one? Not even Empire. It was a single solar system. Did they ever get to multiple solar systems? That the Hydrans not a subjugated race. Really, I forget what happened with them.
The Borak,
yeah.
Yeah, because in the historical timeline, the Borak and Hydrans kind of intermingled, but it was like open, like both sides were communicating with each other. But the Hydrans kind of, after the conquest of their homeworld, they felt they couldn't take any chances. So they decided to, get their digs in first and, reduce the Borak to a subject species.
Right,
but they still allow the Borak to use civilian ships, and they're still a part of the Hydran economy. It's just that they're not allowed to build their own warships anymore.
Right. But wasn't I'm just thinking about if the history of when it comes to the Borak and the Hydran is that the Borak actually they live on a definitely different planet than the Hydran. The Hydran actually were interested in like one of the gas giants that was in the same solar system, something like that.
The Borak live on like terrestrial planets, whereas the Hydrans live in gas giants. So it's actually kind of similar to out in the Magellanic Cloud, where the Batvai, like say for example, if there's a Jupiter-sized gas giant, the Othiki would live on the giant, on the gas giant, whereas the Badivi would colonize the rocky moons, and the two of them would, you know, trade that way.
Mm-hmm. Which always I find is an interesting idea overall, that is that two species can basically kind of quote unquote own the same solar system, and now if they want to, they can interact. If they don't want to, they don't have to interact for the most part. You know, obviously the biggest issue with interstellar travel, and if you have multiple species on two different planets, you still have to interact with them in some level, just to make sure that when it comes to the star lanes, whatever you want to call them, are clear, that they don't have problems of running into each other, basically. Because I'm assuming there would be preferred paths to take to go in and out of the solar system.
Well, part of the thing as well is that, I mean, on the one hand, the Jindarians get away with being nomads.
Right.
But they don't have a home world, whereas, I mean, the Tholians would only be able to pull off that kind of shell game if no one else knew that Tholia Prime existed. Like, they basically have to move far enough away from their home system to be able to portray themselves as nomads to other species, other starfaring species. Because the minute that the other species realize that what's actually going on, then the jig is up, you know.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you think about it, when it comes to the Tholian home world, okay, you got that Tholian home world. You now don't become a galactic empire. But, you know, by staying on your home world and just building up your home world as big as possible. That's not how you do it. You have to go on to different planets and colonize those planets and expand your resource base so that you can, you know, get access to more resources. You can build more ships. You can colonize, basically, you know, out and out. And obviously, at the beginning of the start of any empire, you start small, and then you grow from there. And when you're small, you're one species in the whole galactic universe, you know. So in that case, it could, you know, as you know, Douglas Sadanas was proposing, the whole idea of back in the history, they might have actually been more ignored, basically. You know, they didn't really interact because they couldn't communicate or whatever. But you know, and they built up the empire to a certain degree, to the point where they went, you know, we're large enough. We got enough resources. We got enough ships. We're gonna start, you know, taking control of each of the solar systems, and anyone else but us we're gonna subject them to what we want to happen. You know, I, the Tholian will. So, I can see that easily happening. You know? And obviously, they build up this empire pretty big, because the whole idea of building a Dyson sphere, that's a lot of resources to build up a Dyson sphere. Especially because...
Well, the other thing is that they're not like proper Dyson spheres, in the sense that they're built around kind of artificial suns, like, so they're not much bigger than like regular planets, which is still a lot of work, but not as much as like a traditional Dyson sphere built around a pre-existing star would be.
Right. Agreed. But still, building a Dyson sphere and then creating an artificial sun. Not exactly an easy task. But the whole idea of a Dyson sphere is just incredible. Because I know there's been the whole idea of a certain science fiction universes. That's the whole idea of having like a ring around a star, where, you know, the idea being that you can get, you know, a lot of like feed off the energy from the star at a distance along a ring, you know, which is still awesome technology. Yeah, thanks, Chris. Area of a sphere is 4 times pi times the radius squared, which is huge.
So, yeah, what was I going to say? Well, actually, I was kind of suggesting that they probably wouldn't only build more than a handful of the spheres before they finish conquering the galaxy, because there'd be too much resources need to put into fighting other empires. So it would kind of be a thing that they would do after they've secured their position.
Oh, yeah.
And they can afford to, like, you know, reduce their military budget and also start fleecing galaxies worth of subjugated planets for the resources needed to build them.
True. But at some point, the thing is, you have to build up, in my mind, you have to build up to that point first. You know, you have to be at least cooperative to a certain degree, maybe ignoring to a certain degree, but basically have the ability to do it for the most part peaceably, where you can build up the resources, build up the army to do what you need to be done to conquer other empires. And then you can continue to grow as you conquer. You can build up your resources, build up your army, you know, with that. And which actually is interesting if you think about it when it comes to the Tholians, because of my understanding, the current understanding of when it comes to the Tholian will, is that at least before the revolt, the only race that they used were Saltorians. So it was, you had Tholians and you had Saltorians, and that's all you had. It's not like the Klingon Empire, where you had multiple races involved in the Klingon Empire. You know, or
you know. Okay. Yes. There's like a few things there. One is, I don't know if you recall, we were talking before about the Tholian Master Starship book, where it actually comes with a full list of the auxiliary units that the subjugated species are allowed to use, mm-hmm. In order to function properly. And also some of the civilian units would at that time no longer be used by Tholians, but they would have been used by the subjugated species instead. Then it's also noted that the Saltorians were only the most recent of the enforcer species. There had been at least 3 others beforehand.
Oh, okay.
So what I was actually thinking was, I won't claim all a bunch of credit, because I think other people in the thread were suggesting it too, but I kind of like the idea that the previous subjugated the previous enforcer species, mm-hmm. had in fact been using the same ships that we know as Saltorian. And the Tholians basically handed the blueprints to the next species after the first one was destroyed. So that would basically cut down on the need to produce any new SSDs for a future MN1 product, because they already exist.
Agreed. But the question at that point, would they use the same weapons?
I mean, why not? I mean, Steve Cole was saying that form follows function. I mean, you know.
True.
Large number of Marines, Pardo cannons, shield crackers, you know, they do what they need to in order to suit the Tholians. So,
yeah, but at the same time, that would also presuppose that the same kind of species, same kind of race, i.e. the whole idea of you have a hive.
Well, not necessarily, because I mean, the individual, like a heavy cruiser or whatever, it doesn't really, you know, you could in principle have like a designated homeworld with a shipyard that's building them. So you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, they could be insectoid, they could not be, but, you know, they wouldn't, I guess it just depends on, like,
but
what's the word?
Right, some of the ships, I guess one thing that would have to be done in the case if there weren't insectoids, or at least have that same kind of hive mentality where they have a queen and all that kind of thing, in that things like the hive ship, you know, the battle wagon, those ships, would they still exist?
Well, in Captain's Log 47, they actually showed that the earliest version of the hive and nest ships were cargo haulers, because what would happen is the Tholians didn't trust the subjugated species to know where the spheres were. So what they would do is that they would send these cargo haulers on circuits, and the Sultorians or whoever would show up at a star system. They would dock a freighter into those bays, extract the goods from the freighters, send the empty freighters on their way back to their home systems, and then continue the circuit, go to the next subjugated system, rinse and repeat until the cargo bays were full on the hauler, and then bring that to the construction site, extract the goods and use them towards building the next license sphere. And then, so that's basically where the Sultorians kind of got the hyphen ships in the first place.
Okay.
They were basically, their original purpose was to help build, you know, gather the resources needed to build a sphere.
Right, right. That makes sense.
But I have actually been thinking, because I don't know if you noticed, like, the post just before Steve's last post, I put an idea in terms of like a proposal in terms of like how to kind of account for the pre-conquest history. And of course, the floor is open for people with better ideas to get on the BBS and add their thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
But now, what I was thinking was that as soon as the Tholians started the process of ruling a traditional territory with subjugated species, mm-hmm. even if it was well before they conquered the entire galaxy, they would very soon run into the same issue that caused them to have an enforcer species afterwards, in the sense that they've got all these like horrible carbon-based life forms that they need to extract resources from, but they don't have the tools to do that. So I actually think that it could be that the very first enforcer species could have been recruited as the Tholians were still conquering the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of like a support system in place. The reason why the first rebellion happened was because the enforcer species felt that they'd basically helped do a lot of the work for the Tholians, and they weren't getting any reward for it.
Right, right, right. They got the worst end of the bargain, you know. You know, we're out there, we're killing ourselves to do what you asked us to do, and we're not getting much benefit here. that whole idea.
Yeah. So that's why in the kind of like 1 to 10 list, I suppose, I was thinking that the very first enforcer ships might have just started small, like with frigates and destroyers, and maybe a base station or two.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the way when the Klingons contracted the Vudar, they started them off with really small ships, and only later did they let them build larger ships out of necessity. So it could be that they were more paranoid, I suppose. Well, the Tholians are always paranoid, but
yeah, exactly. Well,
on their guard the most when they first signed them up, so they didn't want to.
From the sounds of it, that there was actually three different enforcer races that they used. You know, and there was actually a revolt multiple times, I'm assuming, at least one time or so forth. You know, I would think almost maybe multiple times. You can understand them being paranoid. you know, that, you know.
So basically my thinking was that, because one of the things that the Pirates of M&A1 Galaxy article was talking about was like a major conflict called the Great Martial War. And after the Tholians won, they moved into the northern half of the galaxy, or the M81 galaxy. So I kind of pictured that as being kind of like the equivalent of the general war, except that someone wins, because, you know, the general war is a draw. But that could basically be the crucible that drove the Tholians to give their enforcers more powerful and bigger ships, or let them build them, rather.
Right.
And there's, like, someone else actually proposed a pre-battle wagon siege engine that, like, basically think about like a battle wagon, but without the waybreakers. Like, it just had shield crackers or phaser ones instead.
Right.
So it wouldn't necessarily be used against the Tholians. It would be used to crack an enemy capital world or something.
Right.
So maybe by the time the Great Martial War ended, the enforcer species was using those, as well as full-on dreadnoughts and battle cruisers and stuff. So they were a very substantial portion of the Tholian military. And that in itself would have, A, helped them get over the edge in terms of, you know, vanquishing the other empires, but also feed into the whole idea that the enforcers kind of felt hard done by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
And of course, it would then allow people to, like any scenarios that were set during the Great Martial War, they'd be able to use the Sultorian ships, or whatever you want to call the name of the first enforcer species,
right.
as well as the Tholian ships. So you'd actually have more variety in terms of what the campaign would look like.
Hmm. Only thing I would hope is, and this might be a vain hope, because if they're just using the Sultorian ships, they might not even want to do that, which is having different weapons. The idea being that, like any other, you know, force, you know, they improve the weaponry over time, you know. You know, the whole idea maybe before the Sultorians, the particle cannons weren't as nice. You know, they only could fire definitely only once every turn. You know, maybe not even have the whole idea of capacitor. Things like that, you know, to show that there was improvements over the years. You know.
I hear you, but Steve Cole's already shot down the idea of early years or pre-refit Tholian ships, so... or I guess Sultorian ones. So it looks like that won't be an option for now, anyway.
Okay.
But well, think about if you look at Module C5. Sorry.
Yeah. All I was going to say was that that's understandable. And to me, if they can get the M81 product out the door, and people buy it, that there's good demand for it, then they might go back and say, you know, we actually, you know, it seems people are interested in M81. Well, you know, enough to the point where we feel like we can produce another product and people will buy that too. Then they'll probably think about an early years. I would think that would occur. Then financially it would make sense.
Well, another way I'd look at it is, if you look at Module C5, I mean, the main hook of the Lesser Magianite Cloud was the Andromedans, be it either the Andromedan Conquest or Operation Unity. But so there aren't actually any Andromedan ships in Module C5. All you see are the empires that they fought against.
Right.
But that's enough, because you don't really need to duplicate the Andros and stuff. So what I'd like is... if the M81 prop module was basically focused around those empires, like let them fight each other as well as fight the Tholians. Like it would be kind of boring if they just sat around doing nothing, waiting to get conquered. I mean, like there's got to be more agency than that.
Right.
So basically, you know, give it more oomph as a setting and kind of highlight the tragedy. Because I think it was like Ken Burnside did a pretty good job in terms of creating a setting that was like had its own life before the Andromedans came to smother it. And so I think that the same should be true for M81 back then. Like, it shouldn't really, I mean, of course it's important to account for that, the fact that the Thonians do eventually win, but I think there's definitely lots of different ways to get there.
Right. Agree. There definitely could be some really interesting history along the way. I agree. Just to let you know, Chris in the Twitch chat room said, quote, "We've decoded some more of the Air Force tapes, and it turns out the Thonians did have earlier ships." It's a joke. So,
well, that would be handy.
Yeah, I had to quote that and let people who are on the podcast are, you know, so they can actually see what was written. But yes, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just one final thing, because I guess we're getting a bit late.
Yes, we are.
I was thinking that you know, I had a couple ideas for like what could make the Nebulon interesting, like different. So one thought was, for a heavy weapon, because one of the early years weapons that the ISC have, the pre-ISC have in Module Y2, if you have a copy of the Master Rulebook PDF, it's in the back of that as well. It's a weapon called the Plasma Vortex Launcher, and it's a double space weapon that can arm over 1, 2, or 3 turns. So I was thinking that a weapon like that would be interesting, but if you made a modern version, like say, for example, because in the early years, you can't hold at any arming level, and you have to basically wait the 3 turns to get to the 3rd army level. But maybe the modern version, you could hold it, and you could maybe do a speedier load where, say, for example, if you've got the first turn of arming, you can like fire at the impulse you want to fire, add in 2 more points, and you're at level 2. Or if you're at level 2, add 2 more points at the turn of at the moment of arming, and you've got level 3. So it's almost like kind of like with a Troban implosion bolt where those weapons are designed to be 3 turn arming, but you can fast load them in the 2nd turn with the full amount that you need.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the Starfleet Battles Master Rulebook, right?
Yeah, the silver one, the 2012 edition. Like near the very back of it, there's a weapon, the Plasma Vortex Launcher, and you can see the arming charts for it there.
Let's see if we can find it. I picked up mine and I'm looking, and I'm looking for Vortex. Play the Vortex Launcher, okay. See it. Got it. The what? Pranholite? Is that what?
They're the lizard people in the ISC.
Okay. Developed plasma technology into the Plasma Vortex Launcher. The weapon was very flexible and was able to fire rapidly with small increments of energy, or more slowly with massive bursts of energy. This allowed the Pranholite ships either dance around the opponent or close in for deliver a solid hammering. The weapon showed some promise of further development, but was discarded after formulation of the Concordium in favor of further development of seeking weapons, which was believed would be more effective against space boars. Interesting. That's like, oh, no, we don't want to work on this weapon because we're really concerned about space boars.
Well, because in the early ISC, they would run into these stampedes of today's space boars, mainly because less than scrupulous mining corporations were like showing up on these planets and digging into the egg chambers for them. So the boars were like, "We're not taking this. Here's a stampede. Try and deal with that."
Right. Understood. Oh, thank you, Chris. Looking at some of never read about that. That's one thing I really should do, which is go back. Cause there's one thing I've not done on this podcast, which is reviewing, going over the early year weapons. And especially when it comes to the ISC, because the ISC has a lot of weapons and you have some in the Federation too, that we have not talked about at all. You know, we dealt with, you know, the Omegas, we've dealt with the LMC, we've dealt with, you know, of course, I don't think we've really gone over the regular Alphas just because that's kind of boring. And everyone knows, anyone who knows Starfleet battles knows those weapons, and versus some of the other less well-known ones, which are early years, which is a less well-bought product compared to the general war products. You know, so maybe sometime actually we'll probably go over this. And definitely, I have to read up on the plasma vortex. I won't read about it now because I am a slow freaking reader, and I think I bore people to tears if I was reading it.
Yeah, don't worry about it right now. But just the second thing I was thinking was, like, you know, the way like the Kolaghar and some other species, they can fire clouds of something, like clouds of plasma or clouds. Mm-hmm. Matter or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking it'd be cool if Nebulon had a support weapon that created like a pocket nebula. So they could use it to either disrupt the formation, or what I was thinking is that you could basically have the weapon, you could have a cloud component, and then you could have like a warp-powered ignition component. And if you ignite the cloud, you trigger the random movement that you have in an active nebula.
Right.
You could basically like almost flash bomb it, and then your enemy ships are pushed in random directions. And what you could even do is that if you're inside a nebula already, you could fire the ignition part without the fuel part. And, you know, like if it's an active nebula, the enemy ships are going to be randomly pushed around already, but you could do that even further, like just to frustrate them even more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you're not using a weapon that's like a blunt weapon. You're using something that's like a trickier one.
Understood. That sounds interesting.
But I don't know whether that would actually work because, I mean, allowing any empire to, like, fire a cloud of nebula in open space, I don't know if that would be permitted or not. But, you know, I think it would be something that would make... It would be just enough to be awkward, but not enough to be a game changer the way that 11 ships with webcasters would be.
Agreed. Okay, so yeah, the question is ADB open to other weapon developments when it comes to the different kind of empires? I'm gonna call them empires.
Well, I hope so, because I mean, it would be kind of boring if all the empires that the Zonians conquered use the same weapons that we already know about. I mean, the LMC was able to invent warp tube lasers and, you know, charge quadricycle federators and mass drivers and all these things.
Yeah, or they do the whole.
I think that would be.
Or they do the whole Andromeda and Phaser 2. They're not really Phaser 2s. This is just how we're simulating what weapon they actually have, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, and actually, one other thing I was thinking too is because if you look at the regular old Galaxy Raider, it doesn't have any benefit inside a nebula. So what I was thinking is that when the Nebulae build them, they build their own versions with, like, they weave in a system that allows it to function in a nebula, but it doesn't work by itself. You have to power it. So think about, like, a Zosman stealth field or, like, a cloaking device.
Right.
The Zosman ship does not have any stealth benefit. Like, it's not like an Orion ship with stealth coating. The Zosman ship has no benefit without the stealth field. It has to run the stealth field to do the stealthy things. So I was thinking that maybe the Nebulines would have some sort of like system, like a nebula field or whatever you call it, which does something similar so that when they run the field, they get benefits when fighting in a nebula, which they're supposed to do according to the historical article. But the article doesn't then tell you what those benefits are. But if there's like a way to kind of pick through the downsides of fighting in a nebula for everyone else, you could say, okay, X, Y, Z don't apply when you run the system. But because you have to pay for it, your ship is slower. So you're not getting it for free.
Right. Definitely. Well, definitely.
Yeah, we don't have to go into it now.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you have a minute, love, I guess with all the other threads, if you have a look at that Nebula thread, I posted a few thoughts in there, and you know, if you think it's nonsense, it's crazy, and something better, by all means, let us know. But you know, I mean, like, I think it would be interesting to, you know, come up with, you know, just different ways of approaching the same issue.
Right. Agreed. I have to read through it because, you know, you started up right when I'm on vacation. And of course, I don't always have a time to actually check out the discussion board these days. But I try to keep an eye on it to a certain degree. So anyway, we'll wrap it up here because Lord knows I'm already going to be probably awake past midnight at this point, because it takes me a while to get things put together and post things up. So, Gary, it's been wonderful to have you on and have this great discussion. And so, you have a good night.
Thank you very much. And I hope everyone, like, if any of those BBS discussions or whatever interest you, by all means, get stuck in sooner rather than later.
Yes. So, people are listening to this or watching this, you know, if you're interested, please join in on the discussion. It looks very interesting and definitely good. I think it's really exciting when it comes to the M81 Galaxy. And if they're going to produce a product for that, because I know that's something I've been waiting for a long time and really been excited with the idea of a Tholian product about the old Galaxy, you know? Okay. Well, had a nice discussion there about M81 and some of the possibility new products that might be coming out of, at least discussions about new ideas around Starfleet Battles, which is always great to hear new ideas and get discussions going about Starfleet Battles and certain things that can be done. Obviously, you know, it's going to be shaped and so forth by ADB itself, because it's their IP. So they're going to do whatever they want. But it's always good, especially when it comes to M81, looks like, you know, Steve Cole is actually actively involved in the discussion itself. So that gives us great hope that something actually will be done. Obviously, I'm sure a lot of people are still waiting on and praying for second generation X ships, and of course those are Kalians, which is another thing to which I know some people are be really interested in. But in my mind, I think going, you know, with M81 first, I think is more interesting to me. But you know, obviously I'm sure there's some people that are kind of, I know there are a few people that are kind of miffed that's about the second generation X ships, and it's like, oh, you know, these rules, we're going to come up with an update. We know these aren't perfect, but you know, we'll come up with an update later, and they never came with an update. So it is what it is. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.